is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, wine exports continue to stay in the doldrums, at least in the latest results that we're seeing for exports. And China could move away from new coal plants by 2030. And that is an effort to reduce its carbon goals within less than a decade. But what implications does it have for Australian coal production?
Our report finds that China is massively accelerating renewable energy. In just the first 3 months of this year, China has installed 61 gigawatts of wind and solar capacity, which is equal to the entire capacity of Australia's national electricity market. This means China is reducing its dependence on coal power, and coal power will fall to less than 50% of China's energy mix by 2030.
We'll have more on that story shortly, and also we'll hear from the Minister Tara Moriarty in regards to the Local Land Services Review, which the review in fact released at the end of last week. We'll get some more details on that shortly as well. But first up today, let's look at the situation with wine. And it seems overseas drinkers are still in love with Australian wine, despite another drop in the value and volume of wine exported out of the country in the past year. Wine Australia's latest report is out today and shows some stabilisation in exports, even as many consumers drink and spend less. While North Americans drank less Australian wine last year, more wine was sent to Asia and the UK, where more people are buying wine to drink at home. Wine Australia's Manager of Market Insights, Peter Bailey, says plenty of our wine is still heading offshore.
So Australian wine exports fell by 1% in value to $1.88 billion and 2% in volume to 611 million litres in the 12 months to March 2024. So these latest figures reflect a relatively stable period for Australian wine's overall export performance in recent times.
Yeah, so as you say, relatively stable. I mean, is that pleasing to see given how much we've been hearing about, people drinking less, consuming less, tightening their belts? Is this a good result?
Oh, look, no doubt the trading conditions are still very challenging, and we've seen growth in some markets in Asia and Europe, but they've been offset by a decline in exports to North America and to a lesser extent other destinations in Asia.
It's not great to see a decline, but given the volatility at the moment, could have been worse.
Yeah, look, I mean, it does remain very challenging to accurately predict how exports are going to continue by market. You know, we've seen that global volatility, which has have been impacted on consumer demand and economic uncertainty, which is undermining, you know, sentiment for discretionary spending on products like wine. However, recent quarter suggests that both volume and value losses have stabilised and a more positive sales trajectory is ahead.
So let's look at, firstly, some of the places that took less. As you mentioned, the North American market, there was a decline there, and we're certainly seeing more of those factors that you were just talking about being reflected in that particular market.
Yeah, there's no doubt in sort of, you know, the US and Canada as well are declining overall in wine consumption, and there's a number of factors such as, you know, an ongoing focus on health and well-being, there's competition from other beverages, and then there's also the rising cost of living.
Where's taking more and why are they taking more?
Oh, look, in some of the markets where we're taking more, like Hong Kong, for example, had some very strong growth. And also in New Zealand, we saw an increase, but also in our number one market, the UK, we saw an increase in value.
Quite interesting behind the data coming out of the UK, quite a trend towards people drinking less in venues and perhaps more at home, so buying wine to consume at home.
Yeah, and that's sort of driving our increase in exports. So, you know, there has been that increase in consumers opting to drink at home rather than bars and restaurants, and that's really to save money during the cost of living crisis, where we've seen, you know, very high inflation in the UK over the last 12 to 18 months. And Australia has a very strong share of the off-premise sales in the UK, and we are the number one category in that segment of the market. So that really does benefit our exports as they move away from the on-premise.
Yeah, so when you break those figures down into, say, more bulk wine or more premium, that higher price point, where's doing well?
If you're looking at the top 10 brands in the UK off-trade, five of those were Australian brands and four of those experienced growth in the last 12 months.
And what about varietals, red versus white? What are people wanting a lot more of in these past 12 months?
Oh, look, it's pretty challenging for both red and whites in our export figures in the last 12 months. So we actually saw red wine exports fall by 2% in volume and 1% in value. And in terms of sort of whites, the exports also declined by 1% in volume and 1% in value.
And we should make the point that even though the tariffs have now been lifted on Australian wine being imported into China, China doesn't factor into this. It's too late to be included in this report.
Yeah, we saw a very small uplift in the last period of March. So overall, off a very small base, China exports were up 21%. However, given the decision was made late in the month, we'll see most of that impact come in the months ahead.
You said right at the beginning, it's very hard to predict sort of what's going to happen given China back in the market. Now it could be quite an interesting report next time around.
Oh, absolutely. And I think we also need to consider that the China market is very different to what it was 4 years ago as well. You know, overall consumption and the import of wine into China has contracted significantly. And wine imports are now a third of what they were 5 years ago. So that would suggest that, you know, even though Australia is very well highly regarded in the market, perhaps the size of the opportunity may not be as big as it was previously.
So exports still a third of what they were a few years ago. Wine Australia's Manager of Market Insights, Peter Bailey, speaking with Selena Green. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 12 minutes past 12. Well, let's turn, and we were talking about China there. We're still with China. It's fast-tracking its move away from coal power with a record investment into renewables in the first quarter of this year. A new report from the Climate Energy Finance says the country could move away from new coal plants by 2030 and could smash its carbon neutral goals by a decade. But what will it mean for one of Australia's key coal export markets? Report co-author Zhu Yongdong explained the findings to Amelia Bernasconi.
Our report finds that China is massively accelerating renewable energy. In just the first 3 months of this year, China has installed 61 gigawatts of wind and solar capacity, which is equal to the entire capacity of Australia's national electricity market. This means China is reducing its dependence on coal power, and coal power will fall to less than 50% of China's energy mix by 2030. And our projections shows that it can stop building new coal power stations before 2030. This is very significant because currently 96% of all new coal power construction globally is in China. And we found that China can bring forward its net zero targets from 2060 to 2050, like the rest of the developed world. This has a very profound implication for cutting global carbon emissions and tackling climate change.
Yeah, wow, there's some huge figures in all of that, Xiang. How surprising was it, though, what has happened in just the first 3 months of this year, given China's heavy reliance on coal in the past?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's that surprising. First of all, the impact of coal pollution and climate change on China's environment has made China a firm believer in climate science ahead of many others. China has seen firsthand evidence of the harm of climate change as a developing nation and the world's factories, such as public health issue caused by air pollution, as well as frequent coastal flooding, storm surges, coastal erosion, and saltwater intrusion. And with the unique top-down political structure, when the central government confirms climate change is a threat to the national security, there will be no room for climate deniers. And second is China's economic past. China has always been prioritizing economic growth over anything else. And last year, we saw 40% of China's GDP growth was driven by the expansion in clean energy.
Wow.
China is in the leading position in the world's renewable energy technology supply chain. And this is a win-win strategy for China as it serves China's national interests and also serves the world by delivering the tools needed for the global decarbonization. And third is China's political system, because there is a central command. So when the government says China must transition its system to clean energy, there will be substantial actions that follow.
I guess that has impacts on Australia, of course, not only our coal exports to China, but also, I suppose, that global peer pressure that Australia might need to up its game, like China obviously is in the renewable space.
Yes, certainly there are implications for Australia. China's transition away from coal power signals a critical shift in the global energy landscape. This includes the, like you said, inevitable decline in demand for coal in China. And the value of coal export is already decreasing in Australia. According to the Office of the Chief Economist, Australia's thermal coal export value is already expected to halve to $33 billion in 2024 from $68 billion in 2022, while coking coal exports are also estimated to fall drastically. So this highlights the need for Australia to diversify its economic base, and we need to transition our economy from historical dependence on coal exports and leverage our world-leading reserves of critical minerals like lithium and strategic metals like iron ore. We can process this onshore and manufacture clean technology here using our abundant renewable energy such as wind and solar resources. And we also need to make sure that the communities like the Hunter that have been the engine room of our nation are not left behind, but also are the leading players in this transition. And we could partner up with clean tech innovators like China to build our sovereign capabilities and secure our domestic supply chains. There is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to ensure Australia can play a leading role in the accelerating global transition.
That's Zhuyong Dong, who's a climate energy finance China analyst, and she was speaking with Amelia Bernasconi about China's rapidly growing move towards decarbonisation, and they might not need as much coal from us. It's 17 minutes past 12.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, the independent review into the local land services has been released, and the minister has decided not to follow some of the recommendations about centralising or re-centralising the local land service to a statewide board. The minister says localism in regions should be protected in her view, but she makes no apologies for the cut in salary to board members, saying it's the best way to reallocate funds to make sure there's more works on the ground. Minister for Agriculture Tara Moriarty is speaking here with ABC Western Plains reporter Catherine James. And we seem to have some problems with the audio there in regards to that. Let's go to our next story, where we're talking about the ICP education, because for 53 years the Isolated Children's Parents Association has been passionate about advocating for equitable access for education for all kids wherever they are based. But there are some extra challenges that regional and rural families face in terms of cost of living and boarding school costs and things like that. Now, the latest statistics on rural versus city education don't make very pretty reading. If you're a preschooler in remote areas, getting to preschool or daycare is tough. Also, starting out at school, country kids are 5% less developmentally ready than city kids. And the latest NAPLAN results show that Year 7 students in the bush, the chances there of achieving above the minimum standard in both reading and numeracy is more than 10% lower than city kids. President of the Isolated Children's Parents Association, Louise Martin, says that more help is needed in this space.
Michael, I think it's a combination of many things as to why rural and remote students are left behind. I think from the very early years, if there's any intervention needed from allied health or you've got learning challenges in any way, it's very, very difficult to source and have a regular service to assist students who have those extra needs. From the very get-go, those kids are behind and often don't catch up because we don't have the services. when it comes to primary schooling in small schools, it's very challenging to attract and then retain teachers in small schools. We often get beginning teachers who don't have much world experience or experience in the classroom, and suddenly they're faced with teaching multi-age classroom, and they don't always have great access to other mentors who might be close by or in the school, if we're talking about little tiny schools. So they're finding it challenging. And then so you're either in a small school or doing distance education. And distance education offers a great alternative if you're not near a normal school. Their students are just generally faced with isolation. That can be a great form of education as well. When you get to high school, many schools in rural remote areas don't even go to have secondary. So, for example, in Queensland, there's 12 local government areas that don't have a high school. So there's lack of access, which means either going to boarding school or continuing on with distance education. When it comes to high school age, students need much more than learning. It's all about social interaction and finding their tribe and their friends, and that can be really difficult if you're doing that physically isolated by continuing on with distance education. And then boarding school is the other option, and, you know, boarding school can be completely unaffordable for some. So then that means their families leave the communities, and our communities feel the loss. So it's a whole mix of things, Michael, of why our rural remote students are trying to play catch up all the time.
And is there a sense that it's getting worse?
I don't know that it's getting worse. It just seems, despite active advocacy and lobbying that ICPA has done over 53 years now, it doesn't seem to be getting much better. The NAPLAN results show how far behind our kids are. And, you know, today, in today's society, there is that expectation that you further your education, be it do a traineeship or go to university or something. Back in the day, it was okay to finish school at 13 and go to work. That was normal and acceptable. There was work for everyone. But families are far more invested in education these days, I feel. It's expected that you go and complete at least year 10 to get a trade, or finish year 12 and go beyond with your education.
But maybe there's something to be said for a vocational education for kids that are, you know, that are isolated, maybe on farms, and maybe they are more suited, a lot of them, to working on a farm or working in that sort of in that vocation where they live.
That's absolutely true. And wouldn't it be great if that was even possible? I was just talking to a teacher at the Charleville State High School last week, and there is not a single person who is accredited to train young people who are still in school to do any school-based traineeships or vet in school, vocational training in school. Not a single person in the whole district who is trained up to do that.
Because they'll still need some training, won't they? You know, even if they're going to know they're going to work on a farm or work in rural industries, they're going to still sort of need some training at the beginning, aren't they?
That's right. And I think bureaucracy has not been kind to us either. You know, there's so many workplace health and safety issues these days. Just to send a green kid out onto someone's property now is fraught with peril from, all of those safety standards, insurance, etc. So that is not helpful. And, you know, kids still, even if you wanting to do an apprenticeship, a traineeship, many, many rural remote students have to leave home to access that. And that is challenging itself. Sending a young kid away from home. They've got to look after themselves, fend for themselves on a very small wage, and the attrition rate is quite high. It's because it's just too much. And it's so complicated for a young kid to access Centrelink and payments and money. They make it so difficult for them.
You mentioned there the kids early on that might be having initial problems. Are there some ICPA ideas about things that should be happening there to you know, get them early and help them out quicker and at an early stage?
Well, Michael, we'd like to see that there is cross-collaboration between the health services and education services. When you're in a rural and remote area, siloing is not advantageous.
Mm.
In these areas, we all need to work together. And if a young child preschooling has been verified with extra needs, that needs to continue on into schooling. Unfortunately, there's a shortage across the board of allied health services who are employed by education departments. So there's a shortfall. The other thing we'd like to see is that there's a number of private providers who service small communities, and we would like to see collaboration between all departments, you know, the education department and other private providers. Whoever is in town is able to help these kids on a regular basis, and that occasionally happens due to the goodwill of some people, but it's not the normal.
National President of the Isolated Children's Parents Association, Louise Martin, talking there about the report card for the standards for kids in the bush and studying remotely in particular. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's coming up to 27 minutes past 12. Well, let's go back to our story about local land services, the independent review. It's been released. A minister has decided not to follow some of the recommendations, particularly about centralising the local land service to a statewide board. The minister says localism in the region should be protected in her view, but she doesn't make any apologies for the cut in salary, saying that's the best way to reallocate more funds to works on the ground. And the Minister for Agriculture, Tara Moriarty, is speaking here with the ABC Western Plains reporter, Catherine James.
It's important that LLS has been in place in its current form for over 10 years. We're a new government. I'm a new minister, and it's important that I have come in with fresh eyes to look at what's working and what's not working across the sector. LLS is a major part of agriculture and the work that happens across regional New South Wales, and it was an appropriate time for us to have a look at it and get feedback from people about what's working and what isn't. And I've done that and also commissioned an independent review to give me advice on how it can be best fit for the future. And I've accepted some of the recommendations of that review, and I think we've set it up pretty well for the future. It's a great organisation. It's doing a terrific job, but, you know, there's always room for improvement, and we've made those improvements.
So the review that I saw that was released last week, it's dated September 2023. Why did you decide to release it now? Was it have you had it since September 2023, or was that when you commissioned the review?
I've had the results of the review for some time, and I've already implemented the recommendations that I've chosen to accept. That included reshaping some of the work around the local land services boards, and that included remuneration. It's a decision that I've made to make sure that money is being spent in a better way and in terms of on-the-ground services for farmers and other landholders across New South Wales. So we've had a look at how the boards were working. The local boards are something that we want to keep in place. That was one of the recommendations. It works well. But they're essentially working as subcommittees of the main LLS board. And so we've amended the structure to make sure they're in line with the work that they are doing. Still protecting local decision making, where there's an election process that's about to get underway, so we want people to get involved in choosing their local representatives. I appoint half of these boards, and I did that over the course of the last week. So this is a good balance of making sure that the boards are working in the way that we need them to, local representation, but also money is being spent where it's needed.
Just talk me through a little bit, like, why did you decide not to, one of the options that they suggested was the single state board with some regional representatives. Why did you decide not to implement that?
So I've considered all of the recommendations that were put to me as part of the review, and what I've done is chosen the most sensible, common sense approach to making sure that local land services is fit for the work that it's doing now and set up for the future. I didn't want to cause too much disruption to the work that is being done across regional New South Wales. It's really important work, and I know that farmers and landholders rely on the work that LLS does. People who are in the sector do really support the local decision making, as do I. So I've wanted to get the balance right between protecting it for the future, but also making sure that it wasn't being too disruptive. So there were recommendations, for example, the one that you've just given, which is that we scrap all the local boards and just have a central board. I want to keep the local decision making that's currently in place. And so that's what I've decided to do.
You mentioned that it's really important work that's being done. Some of the farmers are feeling a little bit that the pay cuts to the board members and the chairpersons doesn't reflect that. They're quite substantial pay cuts. I think the chairpersons' salaries are being cut in half, and the remuneration for the board members is from $20,000 to $5,000. So how does that decision reflect the importance that you give to the decisions that they're making?
Well, it is really important work, and I do support people doing this work, but I want money to be spent on the ground in providing services that are very much needed to farmers and landholders across regional New South Wales. So I have taken the advice from this independent review to make sure that these boards and the local subcommittee boards are working in line with the way that they're actually structured to work. And the remuneration is now going to be in line with what happens in other similar boards across government. But the money is staying in LLS. The other positive thing about this is we've had pretty much the same amount of people applying for these roles as they did 4 years ago. The money hasn't been a factor for people wanting to get involved.
And what about any further changes down the track? So there's been this restructure of sorts, or these changes that you've brought in now. How confident can stakeholders be that you won't continue to make changes or make cuts down the track?
No cuts. The money is staying with LLS, which is really important. I want to make sure that the money is spent where it is needed across regional New South Wales. So, again, whilst I've saved $1.4 million in board fees with the same amount of people applying for the role, so people care about what's happening and they still want to get involved, that $1.4 million will be spent by LLS in on-the-ground services across regional New South Wales. These boards will be in place for the next 4 years, and I want them to be able to do the work that they are commissioned to do. These terms are for 4 years. I want the work to continue over that period of time.
Minister for Agriculture Tara Moriarty speaking there with the ABC Western Plains reporter Catherine James. It's coming up to 27 minutes to one. Time to find out what's happening with the news. We'll get the weather shortly. A bit of rain on the coast, but I don't think there's much in the inland. We'll find out shortly. But first up, Adam Story, what's happening in the news?
The terrible story from the Hunter region yesterday with the 17-year-old girl charged with the stabbing murder of her 10-year-old sister. She's been remanded in custody. The case was briefly mentioned in the Broadmeadow Children's Court this morning, but the teenager wasn't present. There was no application for bail, and the matter has now been adjourned until June. Problems with the budget airline Bonza after the Queensland-based carrier cancelled flights across the country this morning. People basically turning up to airports and just finding that their flights are no longer available. Bonza's chief executive has apologised, saying all services have been temporarily suspended, pending talks on the ongoing viability of the business. And affected travellers have been told they will get a full refund. And that's only just after 12 months after they took to the air. There's going to be some reforms to improve the 000 emergency call service. Telcos are going to be forced to share real-time network information during outages, and there's also going to be a new body set up to be in charge of Australia's 000 system, and this follows last year's Optus outage that left thousands without unable to gain access to 000. And there was a review into that, and the federal government has agreed to the 18 recommendations that were made in that report. Lifeline has released some disturbing figures with... it's saying it received almost 3,500 calls and nearly 1,000 text and web contacts last Sunday, on the day that thousands rallied around Australia to denounce domestic violence and gender-based violence. Lifeline says cost of living pressures, the housing crisis and the recent spike in domestic violence combine to create a surge in the number of people seeking help on that day. And on a lighter note, the English Premier League, these 16 of the clubs have voted in favour of developing plans to introduce a spending cap. Now, some of the players' union is a bit concerned about it, and Manchester City, Man United and Aston Villa voted against the proposal, while Chelsea abstain. Now, under the system, the cap would be between 4 and 5 times the amount the lowest earning Premier League club receives in TV revenue. Now, last year that was Southampton, but they still got £103 million, which is what, about 250?
Yeah, but I mean, when the players are costing that,
well,
one
this,
player.
Well, this is it, yeah. So, sorry, mate, we're capping your wage at a billion.
So, I know.
It's. God. Yeah, but there is it's not a done deal. There is concerns about competition law as well. I suppose if you have a cap in the Premier League, you could see players just going to other leagues that are
that's a good point.
That don't have a cap.
Oh, that's a good point. And if they can spend up big in the lower leagues, like say a club like Wrexham.
Yes, yeah.
They can buy some more strikers.
Yeah. Or Sunderland.
Sunderland,
which is, where my
course.
Ancestors are from. So
right. And also a terrific documentary about them as well.
Sunderland.
Which was the catalyst for the Wrexham.
They made it into the
Premier League.
Premier League about 5 years ago.
They did, but it's been, they're a difficult team to follow. Bit like the Balmain
Tigers.
Like
the Tigers. I'll pick winners, don't I?
Yeah, well, I'm not saying anything about my picks, so there you go. All right, thanks for that, Adam. We'll be back at 1 o'clock, and let's find out what's happening with the weather details. And Ed Medlock's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So we are seeing some coastal rain at the moment, some showers.
Yeah, the big high-pressure system in the Bight at the moment is driving easterlies over the coast, which is bringing coastal showers, which are going to be continuing for pretty much the entire week for most of the coastline, as well as a cold front with a trough going through the northeast, which is bringing a few millimetres of rain and a few thunderstorms here and there to the northeast inland.
Right, okay. So northeast inland, but not too much rain elsewhere in the inland. I see that Dave from Trundle says he's only had but 1.5 millimetres. He'd like to see a whole lot more. So obviously there's not too much rain in the inland as yet.
No, not with this system, but over the coming days we are expecting to see some sort of rain event occur in the inland. There will be a trough building in the western parts of New South Wales, maybe Thursday, maybe on Friday. It's difficult to tell the timing at this point, but there is the potential for widespread rain of 20 millimetres with isolated spots of 50 millimetres with storms out in the maybe the western parts of the state, but also definitely possible in the central and the slopes. That system sort of moves east through Friday and through the weekend. We're looking at Saturday sort of toning down a little bit to 15 millimetres widespread with, again, isolated spots of 50 millimetres in storms, but that will be closer to the slopes as it moves east. And by Sunday, that system will be over the coast, enhancing some of that coastal rainfall that we're already seeing at the moment.
So are we going to see sort of widespread rain of 10 to 20 millimetres throughout the inland and the sort of crop-growing regions, Riverina, Central West, or what areas... likely to get the most?
The areas that will get the most sort of centred around Cobar at the moment, that's what the modelling is sort of saying. Sort of Cobar, Bourke, Ivanhoe, sort of that north, northern, central parts of the state. And the places which aren't so certain is kind of the southern parts. They're not expecting to get as much of this widespread rain. So we're sort of focusing in the northwest. That's on Friday and Saturday, that is.
Right, and you mentioned the coastal rain, and that's, I'm looking at some of the forecasts, I was saying a number of days where there'll be rain continuing on the coast. Was up and down the coast, the whole coast of New South Wales?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's going to be more focused around sort of that metropolitan sort of area, but the entire coast will see showers pretty much persistent through the whole week, except sort of the far north. They're a bit lighter up there. But yeah, from the south all the way kind of to Port, maybe Port Macquarie, is going to see showers persistent throughout the week. And then again, once that trough reaches the coast, it'll enhance all those totals over the weekend.
Right, okay. So is it going to move sort of over the divide, or the other rain is coming from the other direction? Or where is the rain coming and going, I guess?
Yeah, so we've got that coastal showers that's being driven by that high, which is south of the Bight at the moment. That's the persistent showers that are going to be going through the week, and then an additional rain event coming from that trough that builds in the west from Thursday/Friday, which will slowly move east over the weekend and eventually reach the coast. And combined with that high-pressure system, the rainfall combined to enhance those totals over the coast moving out to Sunday.
Right, okay, so the sort of a combination coming together, the bringing the moisture in, that's going to make that change, is it?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm. And is it right that we will see rain for like a number of days, like 6 or 7 days on the coast?
On the coast, the inland event is just really that weekend period. On the coast, that we're expecting to see conditions that we're seeing right now with kind of showery, very cloudy conditions pretty much right through the week and into the weekend.
Right, okay. So no sort of let up, and there's not another system coming through that might push it all through?
We're not seeing that at the moment, and sort of the earliest, even in the outlook period, Monday and Tuesday, those coastal showers really look like they're continuing, maybe a bit lighter on the totals in that later period. But yeah, there's not seeming to be any break for the coast for the time being.
Okay, well, I think that there might be some people in the Central West and Riverina that might want to see a bit more than what's being forecast. But anyway, it'll all be welcome when it falls.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay,
I'll
Ed.
Keep it in mind.
Yeah, exactly. Ed Medlock at the Bureau there. It's coming up to 19 minutes to 1.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Well, domestic violence is under the spotlight right around Australia at the moment. Today, the crime statistics around violence against women have jumped up again after a reduction in those statistics that we saw during the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, the Country Women's Association has put forward a number of motions over the years about improving access to services for women in country areas and also for women on farms when they're dealing with domestic violence. Joy Beams is the state president of the CWA, and she says isolation and farm business issues and just generally living in a country town, some of those issues tend to magnify the issue of domestic violence for many of her members at the CWA.
Yes, it is. And we've actually had policy. We introduced one in 2020 and another one in 2022 to deal with this. We had one of our Awareness Week campaigns about domestic violence, but I don't know, it just seems to be crazy at the moment. It's just got much worse, or maybe we're hearing more about it now. I know that traditionally women in the country tended not to talk about it, like maybe now, but it's certainly more prominent in rural areas than what it seems to be in urban areas. And you wonder whether it's a lot of factors that affect country people more than others. They say that the figures show that after natural disasters that the rates of domestic violence increase quite dramatically. So drought, bushfires, flooding and whatever. So I think maybe that's something that people can be more aware of. If they're aware that that's when there's a major increase, they can be more vigilant.
Aware that there are stressors out there and that people are maybe more at risk. And is there a sense, though, that from the CWA that their members and sometimes feel as though when they're on a farm, it's very difficult for them to get away or have other options?
Exactly. That whole isolation thing can be quite huge. And also, if it's really quite bad, the time lapse in getting police to anything is quite amazing as well. They just can't, that I suppose they just don't have the options available to people that are closer to those urban centres for support.
Even when people try and escape or they go to town, everyone in town probably knows them as well, and their partner probably knows where they are. So it's even, it's difficult to escape even if you get to a local town.
That's exactly right, yes. And the whole lack of anywhere for them to go, there's no emergency housing in a lot of places, there's just nothing, they're trapped.
And if a relationship breaks down, I gather with a lot of the way farms are structured with family trust and things like that, that makes divorce and separation, that in itself is also quite difficult too.
It is, very, very. You know, they walk away with nothing, so a lot of times they tend to stick around because the other option's too hard.
So financially they're facing a real issue if they leave.
Yes, yes, very much so. It's a very difficult situation for women on the land. You know, it's even hard in the smaller country towns, but like you say, you know, everyone knows where they are, everyone knows who they are. It's so much harder to deal with in those small communities.
Do we need to have some of those services or some of those, you know, some of that emergency housing that needs to be made available in maybe some of the nearby bigger centres?
Yes, yes, very much so. And you know, the whole access to legal advice too, that's been taken away. They used to have that legal aid for family issues, but I believe that that's been removed. You know, to even try and get some legal stuff to enable them to move forward, that's hard as well.
And they may not have any actual physical access to money to do that, because it's all tied up in the farm bank accounts.
Yep, yep. Very, very difficult situation for women on farms particularly to try and deal with the whole issue.
And have you seen, you know, more lobbying of CWA from your members on this issue too?
Yes, well, because like I said, we had one in 2020, another one in 2022, but we've certainly had a lot more interest and requests for follow-up on the policies in the last few weeks.
And probably a topic that will arise at your conference coming up next week.
Yes, yes, it will, certainly. But I know that there's been talk about another urgency motion to put our standing on a much stronger footing. So we'll see what comes up in the next couple of days.
On domestic violence?
Yes.
Joy Beams is the State President of CWA, Country Women's Association, and they're having their annual conference next week in Coffs Harbour, and we'll have some reporting on that here on the Country Hour. It's 13 minutes to one.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Hello, I'm Rachel Mealy. Join me for The World Today. Australia is placing a bold bet on the future of quantum computing. The federal and Queensland governments are investing in a plan to build the first commercial quantum computer. Could this pave the way for scientific breakthroughs, or is it a gamble that's not worth taking? And failure to take off. Bonza Airlines cancels flights across the country as it considers the viability of its business. The World Today.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, the first importation of live llamas from North America in nearly three decades has brought some much-needed new genetics into Australia's herd. There are only around 1,200 llamas in Australia, and one breeder has been on a personal mission for nearly 2 years to add to that. Jane Acklin from Womboyne in southern New South Wales has just received the animals from the quarantine facility outside of Melbourne, and says it's been a long journey to get them here.
Importing llamas was really a project of the heart for me. It took 2 years to go from an idea that seemed highly unlikely to actually having these five beautiful llamas arrive in February this year. I'm actually a relative newcomer to the Australian llama community, having only just bought my first llamas around 5 years ago. They grew from being companion animals to me and to my family to having therapeutic value for us as my young nephew Mitch fought his battle with cancer. Mitch and his sister Jess helped train and care for the llamas, and Mitch would find comfort in the photos and videos of the llamas when he was receiving treatment in Sydney. Tragically, he lost his battle with cancer at age 16. And I then was not long after diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, along with rheumatoid arthritis, and left the workforce ahead of schedule. And the llamas and their curious, gentle social nature were bringing me peace and new purpose. And what I decided I wanted to do as my next project was to continue to improve the quality of the Australian llamas that I've got in my herd. And it had been a really long time since Australia acquired new genetics. I believe the last import that we had from the United States was from Mick and Anita Westcombe's import in the mid-1990s. And that was the last major import to come in.
So now around three decades, there hadn't been new llamas into Australia. And as you've just outlined, this is something deeply personal for you. So what was the journey like to find the llamas that you wanted to bring into the country and also get them here?
There actually were llamas imported, I think, from New Zealand after that US import in the mid-90s. And I did look at New Zealand, but I decided that the type of llama that I was looking at was the type that was found in North America. Most of the llamas we have here in Australia came from South American origins, of course, and North American development. But I really liked the style of the very tall, athletic llamas that I could see in some of the long-standing breeders over in the US. I read all of the articles that were online. I joined the International Llama Registry and did the research on genetics through to really long-standing ancestry details. And I was watching live streaming American llama shows and auctions to try and get a sense of the market over there and what the animals looked and moved like and what their produce was like.
Then you had to bring the llamas here. So you buy llamas in America. What's their journey like? Do you fly them? Do you ship them to Australia?
Yes. And look, just to show how this is a question of passion for me, I actually bought them before I had approval to bring them in. And fortunately, I had some really wonderful breeders who were very understanding and patient with me, because my first inquiry to buy a llama was taking place in November 2022, and they didn't actually fly out until January 2024. So it was a really long time, and I first reached out to the USDA, or the United States Department of Agriculture, as well as the Australian Department of Agriculture, Fitness, Fisheries and Forestry in April 2023, and had really great support and great help from both of those organisations in finding our way through. The two countries needed to redesign their import conditions and agreements because it had been such a long time. Previous import conditions were no longer being practiced over in America, particularly with respect to blue tongue virus, and so they needed to change that. I had an exporter who was very helpful in connecting all of the dots over there in America, and they spent 1 month in quarantine in Chicago.
Jane Ackland, who's a llama farmer from southern New South Wales, talking there to Warwick Long. Let's go to markets. First up to Wodonga cattle.
Good afternoon. Cattle numbers jumped up to 1,800 at Wodonga. However, quality remained mixed. Many cattle needed more finish and were better suited for feedlots and restockers. There was increases in buyer activity compared to the previous sale. This did make a significant difference, especially after last week's cheaper sale. The standout performers were heavy cattle. These cattle gained 20 to 40 cents. Heavy steers and bullocks sold in a range of 270 to 328. Heavy heifers jumped 20 to 30 cents, selling from 274 to 312. Cow buyers showed increased interest, and companies were specifically looking for good big cows with plenty of yield. Heavy cows sold at 244 to 265, jumping 27 cents. Leaner types benefited from strong restocking demand, 140 to 228. In the trade market, veal sold from 320 to 402. The better calves held firm. Trade steers remained firm to 10 cheaper, ranging from $3 to $3.50. Trade heifers bounced 20, 285 to 310. Feeder steers experienced a decline of 20 cents, which was quality related, while the heifer portion gained 10. Overall, feeder heifers were priced at 230 to 310. Leanne Dax, MLA.
Let's go to Forbes Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. Numbers ease slightly with agents yarding just over 26,000 head. There's 21,850 lambs penned and quality continues to be mixed but fair with some good runs of trade and heavyweight lambs available along with those planar and secondary types. The usual buyers are present and competing in another dearer market. Trade weight lambs 20 to 24 kilos sold from $132 to $169 a head. The heavy lambs 24 to 6 kilos ranged in price from $170 to $215, while those extra heavyweight lambs over 26 kilos sold from $184 to $251 a head. The best heavy hoggets reached $150 a head, and the balance of the lambs and 4,200 head of mutton are still to be sold. This has been Crystal Ridley at Forbes from LA.
Let's go to Carcor Cattle.
Numbers remain similar to last week with 1,800 cattle yarded. Quality was mixed with good pens of prime yearlings and feeders available, along with some planar types. Heavy grown cattle were also in good supply. All the regular buyers were operating and competing in a dearer market. Young cattle to the trade were 12 to 15 cents stronger. Prime yearling steers sold from 308 to 334, and yearling heifers 280 to 353. Feeder steers held firm, selling between 260 and 369, while for the feeder heifers gained 20 cents, 280 to 317. Prime-grown steers were considerably dearer, selling from 240 to 333, and prime-grown heifers were 20 dearer, 230 to 324. Cows improved 12 to 16 cents, with 2 and 3 scores selling between 140 and 228, while heavy prime cows sold from 222 to 245. Bulls reached 230. This has been Angus Williams for MLA at CTLX.
Let's go to Gunnedah Cattle now.
Good afternoon. A run of very good high-yielding cows were a standout in a reduced penny of 1,215 head. They sold strongly in line with the quality. Weaners well supplied, as were yearlings. Not many heavy-grown steers or heifers. There were plenty of cows. A full field of buyers in attendance for a market that saw dearer trends for the most part. Quality-related price change in some classes. Strong restocker competition saw weaner steers dearer with strong breed-related gains. Up to 330 kilos, sold from 330 to 410. 10 cents a kilo. Heifers sold from 260 to 325, while shop dealers made 350 cents. A better quality penny of yearling steers were dearer, 15 to 20 cents a kilo. Medium weights 300 to 384, with the heavy feeders 300 to 380. Little bit quality related change, the medium and heavy yearling heifers 275 to 328. No trade yearlings. Quality contributed to price change on a firm to dearer trend in the cow market, with restocker cows 175 to 223, while the heavy 3 and 4 score cows sold from 179 to 235 cents a kilo. James Armitage for MLA in Gunnedah.
Thanks, James. Let's go to Inverell Cattle now with the details. Here's Stephen Adams.
Inverell penned 1,034 mixed cattle, increasing by 454 with a slight increase in cows. Regular buyers attended to a much dearer market. Weaners considerably dearer to restocker 316 to 372. The steers 220 to 272 for the heifers. Light background steers 30 better 288 to 324. Light feeders significantly dearer 290 to 344. Medium feeders firm 264 to 362. Similar rises for heifers. Light background is 23 better 248 to 290. Light feeders 8 dearer. Medium feeders 11 dearer 270 to 310. Cows improved for all grades. Medium weights average 176. Heavy cows 20 better 190 to 229. Restockers 190 to 204, and best bulls to 251. Stephen Adams, MLA at Inverell.
And let's get the details now on the Scone cattle sale.
Good afternoon. A nominal rise of 110 head saw Scone agents yard 586 cattle amongst light showers. Market dearer from the word go. Restocker steer weaners up to 40 cents dearer, 296 to 376 for the British breads, 360 to 394 for the Euros, over 330 kilos making to 344. Restocker heifer weaners up by 17, 258 to 314. Once again, the Euros outdoing the British breeds, 276 to 324 to be 22 cents dearer. Medium weight yearling steers to the lot feeders up by 23 cents, 308 to 350. Very few over 400 kilos made up to 320. Medium weight yearling heifers, 198 to 330 to be 26 cents better off. Light two score cows, 25 to 44 cents dearer, 176 to 212. Heavy 3 and 4 scored prime cows, 16 cents dearer, 208 to 234. Angus Barlow for MLA at Scone.
And that's the market information for today. It's 1 minute to one.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
I'm getting a few texts on the rain too, and Dave says that they've only had 60 millimetres for April. They had 1.5 millimetres of rain, just enough to wet the gauge today. 60 for April, and they had 30 millimetres for April last year. And at Warren, John says they've only had 9 millimetres of rain. So that's at the inland, certainly not getting the rain as yet. You're listening to The Country Hour. We're heading up to news time.